Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks, what the fuckocrats? What's happening? My name is Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Happy Monday morning. Good morning to you. I don't know when you listen to this, but man, I hope you made it through the weekend. I hope you're hanging in. Today on the show, Tracy Ullman is here. Do you know Tracy Ullman? Do you remember Tracy Ullman? I shouldn't say it like that. She's always been doing things. She's got her second season of her HBO show, which is called Tracy Ullman Show, that premieres this Friday, October 20th. She's done a lot of stuff, a lot of characters, a lot of things. Insanely talented human being, that Tracy Ullman. She's going to be here in just a bit. Oh, my God. I got to get back into the Sam Pants. It's time for Sam Pants. I'm a little nervous about Sam Pants. I'm shooting today. Today is the first day of shooting for the second season of the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, GLOW. And, you know, I quit nicotine. I got a lot of other things going on and quit coffee. So I'm feeling a little doughy, feeling a little thick. And now I got to get back into the Sam Pants. I hope the Sam Pants fit because I don't need any extra discomfort on set. First script is... looks good. Don't know where the season is going, but there are some things that are set in motion right out of the gate, and it's I'm excited. I'm excited to be going back to work to do the TV show, because now that means I can just add more work. I can do the TV show. I can do the podcast. I can do stand-up, and I can have no time for anything else, and I can just slowly, you know, anxiously come unhinged. Great plan, right? We were just up in the Bay Area, Brendan McDonald, my producer and business partner, and myself were up at Litquake. We did we were in the Mission at the Alamo Draft House, which is, I think, the old Mission Theater, doing an event, a Waiting for the Punch event. The book, I think, is doing well. It's hard to know with books, but a lot of people came and a lot of people were excited. A lot of people bought books both at the New York event and at the San Francisco event. We're going to try to fit in some more events. I think we're going to do one in Los Angeles and maybe some up north. I don't know. It's kind of tricky because, as I said, I'm shooting a TV show. I'm doing a podcast. I'm doing stand-up. And I've got other things going on in my personal life that I'm not going to disclose at this point in time. Everything's good. Not a big problem, other than the world is ending, shit is on fire, earths are quaking, and people are coming unhinged. Some days, man, I don't know what it is, but there's just a ripple through the culture where everyone's just fucking unhinged on the street. Yesterday was one of those days where just people, you walk down the street and you just hear someone yelling. It's got that distant crazy person sound. Just someone, you know, there's a certain pitch that occurs when the brain, it craps out. That it's elevated, and when you hear it outdoors, you're sort of like, what's going on over there? What's happening wherever that guy's yelling? So sometimes it just seems like it's all over the place. Excuse me, I'm drinking some tea. So, yeah, but the events went great. I hadn't been up in San Francisco in a while. I went up, Sarah the Painter had a lovely opening at the Tony Meyer Gallery or Fine Arts Place. Her gallery up there. We did that opening Thursday night. It was lovely. Met some painters, some artsy types, some poets, some thoughtful people. Then and the paintings were spectacular. Then the following night, Brendan and I do this event. He talks to me. I talk to him on stage, and we take questions. And that went great. Had some nice food in San Francisco. As I've been to San Francisco a lot. I lived there briefly. I don't know. I never know what is happening. I always feel. I started to realize this time that perhaps the Victorian architecture, so many Victorian structures, that maybe it just feels fucking haunted to me. I never really put it together. There's a lot of chaos and riffraff, and you feel like you're at the edge of sanity on most streets in San Francisco. Not in a bad way. There's not, it doesn't feel, there's a pretty bad homeless problem, and there are certain areas of the city that are nuts, but the entire city itself just feels like it's on edge. And if you look at the way it's sort of structured, there's no grid, everything's cutting into the other street, and then the rolling hills of just homes defying God to shake them down. And just there just seems to be something, there feels like a frenetic edge to San Francisco. Even when you get out into the hippie regions, which are now on fire, that was the other thing. Very fucking devastating, very sad. My heart goes out to anybody who's battling those fires or losing, you know, homes and friends in those fires. It's just horrible, and it's ongoing. And you could feel it in the air. You could taste it in the air in San Francisco. You could barely breathe, and it was just disturbing and heartbreaking what's going on up in Northern California with these wildfires, just completely out of control. And it's really hard. It gets harder day in, day out, not to lump all this stuff together, not to think like, maybe do I need to read Revelations again? Could it possibly? I mean, am I off about this? Am I being too practical by being atheist? Is it happening? I know there are people committed to it happening. There's the resurgence in a big way of Christo-fascism, which is, you know, always exciting. Has a lot of support. Not all the people, not half of the people, but enough to make it very uncomfortable. The Christo-fascists, they're coming up. They're coming up. And our president, who is, I think, practically, in most practical terms, Satan, the evangelicals have made a deal with Satan to pursue their agenda. And that it's always been teeming. It's always been under the surface. It's always been there. It's been there for years. But now they got their guy. And who would have known it would have been Satan? That makes perfect sense. So maybe I'm going to revisit Revelations, because the fires, the earthquakes, the complete applied irony of the end of this governmental system. Every day, hard to transcend. Sometimes I'm giddy with terror. Giddy with terror. That's the approach. Just remember, at all times, there's a very powerful force and momentum of ideological people that are trying to put in place what needs to be put in place to secure their place in heaven and the kingdom of the hereafter. So just know that the applied prophecy element is intact, and that many people are working towards Armageddon. And it's something they see needs to happen to fulfill their ideological and spiritual agenda. Yeah. Death is better than life to a lot of people. They're looking forward to it, and they want to take a lot of us out with them. So, terrified and giddy. So, I told you about San Francisco. That went well. Having a little problem. Had to get, you know, there's so many things you got to do to protect yourself. And I'm talking on a technological basis. I think I've out-secured myself. I got very frustrated. I try to keep my shit together. I'm trying to keep a level head in general. I feel a little better without the caffeine, without the nicotine, other than being a little chubby. I think my anxiety is limited. But I had to get some line of credit approved. I didn't realize I had to do it. I had to sign up for something, and they had to, you know, go and check my credit. And because Experian, the credit agency, my identity was stolen a few years back. Some of you remember that ordeal. And because I filed a police report, which, you know, doesn't go anywhere, but you have filed it and you tell Experian that you did that. And then they put an alert on your social security number for 7 years, which is great. But I had to use my social security number. And they asked me these series of questions from Experian over the phone to authenticate. And I couldn't answer them. And these were questions designed to protect me. And what they did was they protected me from me. And I can, now I got to go down to the place with a passport because I out-secured myself. I mean, passwords are one thing, but these questions were ridiculous. I don't fucking remember my landline number from 20 years ago. I barely remember the addresses of where I lived. So I screwed myself, but that my social security number is safe. I can't even get to it. Tremendous. God, man, it's going to get crazy. It's going to get crazy now. 3 months. 3 months. I got to look at it like that. You got to look at, you know, when you're entering a fucking cycle of insanity. It's like, well, I'm out in 3 months. Who the fuck knows what's going to happen in 3 months? Anxious. Anxious. Terrified and giddy. My guest today, Tracy Ullman. Incredibly funny. Amazing. I don't know you would call her an impressionist because, you know, she does characters, she does impressions, but she commits, man. The second season of her HBO show, which is called Tracy Ullman Show, premieres this Friday, October 20th. This is me talking to the amazing Tracy Ullman. So you're not, we established you're not a cat person, really. You don't have a...
I do like cats.
Yeah.
My daughter has two cats, but they're just really mean to us.
Oh, really?
The whole family. They like her, but they're just really...
Well, what do you expect
One's
from them?
One's completely mad and feral.
But,
oh. Just sits underneath the sofa and...
Where'd she get that one?
Hisses at people with sort of yellow eyes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other one's called Edith and just loves Mabel and that's it. And just, you know, I go around there, I do the litter box, I, you know, I feed her, I take her treats. And at the end of it, I just go, so bye, Edith. And she goes, and jumps at me and slashes
Nothing.
My chest.
You got to fight.
There's not a lot in it for me.
I know, but that's, you have to be patient.
I know. And wait for... Well, Mabel says that, but it's... You know, when I go home, my dog is just great.
I know, but I don't trust that. It's just sort of like, I get it. You like me. I don't that much affection from anything. Yeah. I find disconcerting. But you know, that's me. I got problems.
Yeah, you like to. I know, maybe
like a little struggle.
Intense. It's so obvious you would be a cat person just having met you. Just
really?
Yeah, you can spot cat people, and all cats voted Brexit. That's my theory. No. They would. Do you know what I mean?
No,
they don't want other. They want European cats coming over, taking their litter, taking the food. They all voted Brexit.
I don't. I will not accept that. My cats are very progressive.
Well, look where you are, Eagle Rock cats.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
These are Eagle Rock cats. They're progressive. They're nervous. They're inclusive, but it takes a little while. Like, I introduced a black kitten into... I got two old cats. You saw them on the bed.
They're
there.
Very PC about the black kitten.
It took time. It took time.
Really?
Well, there was a lot of skirmishes.
Skirmishes?
Cat skirmishes.
You don't have the old coyote problem? Because that's a problem
living
in LA.
Outside. I'm not going to let him outside anymore.
Yeah, well, I did. I got a cat for my son, Johnny, and it was like eating on the lawn. You know, that's the problem here. They just...
Yeah, one of them. There were outdoor cats.
Eagles swoop down, take them off. It's
a
dangerous
horrible.
Place.
But it's also the way the world works, Tracy. That's the ways of the wild. I lost a feral cat recently to something.
To the coyotes, yeah.
Yeah. So, I've been meditating on your career.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite expansive.
Yeah.
Do you look back? You're really, I mean, we're almost the same age, and I have not accomplished anywhere near what you've done. When you sit and think about it, do you ever sit and think about, like, oh my God, I've been in show business forever.
40 years. Well, I started dancing when I was 16.
Isn't it incredible?
Yeah, it's
and
really
you've had
weird.
So, you've had many shows with your name on them. Well, they always seem to involve your name.
Well, it's the easiest way for the TV guide. And if me and my husband always owned them. So we wanted to sell them.
Yeah.
So you just put your name on them. Why are you going to try and be mysterious?
And you stayed married for a long time?
I know. My lovely husband. Yeah, I lost my husband. He died 4 years ago nearly.
Oh,
but yeah, we were married 30 years.
And it was good?
He was my fella. He was great. He made me laugh all the bloody time. But I've got his two kids.
Yeah.
And they're,
his?
They're not, just,
are they
I got my
too?
Daughter. Yeah.
Yeah.
He looks so like him.
Yeah. How old
my
is she?
My son is 26 in a minute, and he's like his dad. He really makes me laugh. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And the daughter
so, my daughter's 31. Yeah, Mabel.
Yeah.
With the cats.
Yeah. She doesn't make you laugh?
Oh, she's hilarious. They're just fabulous. Fabulous.
Are they a show business?
No, Mabel, when she was three, somebody said, do you want me in an actress like your mommy? And
yeah.
She said, no, I want to be something useful, like a nurse.
Oh.
She's very disparaging about show business.
What does she do?
She wanted to be a politician. She worked at the Houses of Parliament for 5 years.
So they're both in Britain?
She nearly got... No, Johnny lives and works
yeah.
here. He's working on James Corden's show right now. He's helping out on that.
James has been in here. I've been on his show. He's an excitable fella.
Excitable. He's got a lot of energy.
He does.
He's got big plans for a British boy. He's very confident. But he's been...
he's doing all right, I guess, in that time spot.
He's been very good to my son. Yeah, he is. He's come over and he's done it. And he's...
That car karaoke thing, that's the star of that show.
That's a very smart premise, isn't it?
It is.
It's a spin-off.
It's very entertaining.
It's so great. He gets people to be totally natural and admit stuff and talk to him that in a way they never would.
Yeah.
In a couch interview
yeah.
format.
In the car, so. You mean? Or
yeah.
on a show? Yeah. No, there's something sweet about
it's
people
lovely.
Singing.
Yeah, and Elton John and, you know, it's the best interview I'd seen him give in a long time. And
oh, yeah.
I think he's really learned how to listen to people.
Did you know him in England?
No, not really. I was in... Into the Woods, the movie, I was a little, I had a part in that, and we sort of crossed paths in that.
But you didn't know him as a TV presenter? Or what was he? He was an actor,
he
wasn't
an
he?
He was an actor, yeah. I remember seeing him in the History Boys at the National and in One Man, Two Governors, which I think really attracted the attention for him to
yeah.
CBS give him a go.
But your daughter's in politics.
Yeah, she was. She's really passionate about politics. Always was. I took her to the House of Commons. And
yeah, and that was it? Planted
the
seed?
She was like seven, and she looked at the House of Lords and the House of Commons and said, I want to be in there with the real people. She
with
pointed
the real
to the
people.
House of Commons. Oh, yes. She was always saying very profound things, our Mabel.
And because I watched a bit of you doing Theresa May.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed something in watching a newer thing, like all the way through... Your ability to mock and humanize simultaneously is the real gift, isn't it?
And I'm not nasty, actually. I think people. I can't. And it was a tough time to impersonate Theresa May.
But you know, but you made her sympathetic somehow. That's
yeah,
not a bad thing.
She is. She's like because I know that sort of English woman so well, you know. Sort of talks like that, you know, and it's all very, well, let's just get on, shall we? And she's a vicar's daughter from Maidenhead. And I know exactly where she's from. And yeah. my sister's the same age as her. And we grew up near her.
Yeah.
And you couldn't be more different, you know, me or Theresa May. And, yeah, she's got a bit of a hunchback. She looks like if Nosferatu and Oscar Wilde had a child. She looks like the vicar from the Barchester Chronicles, a
yeah.
Trollope novel. And she's just Dickensian looking. I mean, it's... But the man that plays my husband in it is yeah. Philip. He was just wonderful. We had a wonderful day being them. And
yeah.
Knowing how in pain she must be right now. We shot it just after the election and that terrible Grenfell fire. And, you know, I thought, can I do this? This is, you know, there's so much suffering this woman can go through. And then Tracy Ullman impersonates her in prime time. It's like, leave her alone, you know? But then we did it and it was just fabulous fun. And
the nation
needed it.
The nation needed it.
Yeah.
You showed up for the... See, like, as an American who's relatively ignorant or at least disconnected from the nuances of British politics, I don't know what you're all going through over there.
It's rough. I mean, Brexit was, for me, it was just awful.
Because at that moment, you realized that you were surrounded and did not know necessarily... the disposition or ignorance or contempt of your fellow British people?
Yeah, it was just a bad mistake for David Cameron to call a referendum. He didn't need to do it. It was to, you know, silence his backbenchers and all those reasons. And it was, I mean, I love being a European, you know,
yeah.
since, you know, we've been in Europe. It's like, I don't know. I mean, I remember it before we went into Europe. It
yeah.
was pretty crappy. We ate spotted dick and... things like that. And
what is spotted dick?
Oh, it's a sponge pudding with raisins in it, and it's just a great thing to say, isn't it?
Would
you like
fun.
Some spotted dick?
Yeah.
And I'm so scared we might go back to our old culinary habits in England.
That's
once
the big
we
concern.
That's my concern. I mean, it's been great having the Italians and the French there. They bring in all the great food, you know, with the food level in England. We went up, and all, you know, and we can all get on that tunnel and go to France for lunch. And
do you think now that's going to go away?
they're pissed off with us. I mean, it's odd. It's a weird feeling psychologically, especially in London, you know, the big city. And but it, you know, yeah, it's, I mean, it's the same as here, you know, real life. And then I'm an American too, and I came home to vote in November, and I got that Brexit gut about 8 o'clock. I thought, this is not going
well, I thought
something bizarre is going to happen here too.
When I saw the Brexit vote, that was when I realized, like, oh, this guy can win.
Yeah, did you?
I did, sort of. Like, that's, I likened it to that scene in Godfather 2 where Michael Corleone sees the guy blow himself up, and he says to Lee Strasberg, he says, I saw this guy blow himself up, and Strasberg goes, what does that mean to you? He says, it means they could win. Like, there's a moment there globally where you're like, the momentum is there.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so what's happening there now? What's going to, is it just stalled?
Well,
is
just
it
tons of negotiations and, you know, as you know, Theresa May called an election and
That was a mistake.
Disastrous.
Do you think it's going to not go through?
I hope not. I mean, I think it'll dissolve into a mess. I don't know. I mean, I think we'll be begging them to come back in 5 years.
Right, they'll just stop talking about it and hope it goes away.
And as soon as then all those flats they've built for all those people that work in the city, you know, you see those big hoardings everywhere, and it's always young people with Burberry bags on bicycles waving. And they're always like young professionals coming to London, buying lots of flats and shopping a lot and drinking organic coffee. They ain't going to come anymore. And once our, you know, financial services stuff starts to collapse in the city, everyone's going to really panic. I don't know. It's not going well, Mark.
Yeah. And are you living there full time now?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah?
But
are there still good things? Because I was just there and I don't know a lot about it, but like I always feel when I'm in England or when I'm in London, which I'm not there for that long ever, that like this place has been here a long time.
Mm.
It's seen a lot of stuff, good and bad. And it just seems like the people are pretty, you know, tough about it. Mm. And that it doesn't feel like I didn't feel. But then again, I was just going on, you know, whatever psychic vibe I was getting. It didn't
Where
feel.
Where do you stay when you come into London?
I was trying to remember. I stayed right next to the big park there, to Hyde Park, in a fancy hotel that Netflix put me up there.
You're in the center, in the fancy bits. You want to go back to Luton, where they have darts tournaments and vote Brexit. You're staying in the nice bits. See, we're in the. Yeah, you go over there and you're in the bubble.
Yeah.
We're here, we're in a bubble. You go out, you know, my daughter, having worked in politics for years, you know, she was out in the rest of the country. She could see it coming. You know, it's like we do get trapped in these big centers, and
I only had 3 days. I should have made some plans to go out to see a dart tournament.
I love when I see Americans. They go, "How many kilometers is it?" It's like, guys, don't say kilometers.
But where'd you grow up?
I grew up just outside in the countryside, really, the Greenbelt area around London. Gymkhanas, ponies.
I'm
not a Cockney or, you know, a real Londoner, actually.
But you were born in where? In
Burnham, like Slough. Do you know where they set the office, the original Ricky Gervais office?
Yeah.
You know that roundabout you see at the beginning of the show?
Yeah.
That's, they knocked my father's shop down to put up that piece of 60s crap. So I was like, you know, from like 14 miles outside London.
Would it be considered like a suburb of London?
Yeah.
And what kind of shop did your dad have there?
He did everything. He was at Dunkirk, and he was in the Polish army, and he came to London, and he never went back after the war, and he was a lawyer and an interpreter, and he set up a big shop in London for all the Poles that came and made their lives there. And you wanted furniture, you went to John. You wanted
he was
a wife,
like,
you went to John. Right. You wanted a Beatles suit, you went to John. And
he
just
was the Polish conduit.
He was
English culture.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
So he was like he was probably one of those guys that was sort of like the mayor.
Yeah,
in a way, like of that community, like everybody knew him.
That's what my dad did.
And he became a lawyer as well.
He was a lawyer from Poland.
So he helped with legal advice?
Yeah, everything. Yeah, he'd like...
Yeah, so the office that they leveled was his law office.
No, we had like an office. It was a shop. It was everything. He had the Beatles suits in there. You want Winkle pickles? You go to John. You know, he had everything in there. He'd make me dance on the counter for the customers. You know, my Tracy, she's so talented. She's a star. He sold suits, and he used to let a couple of nutty guys that had been in the desert rats who had gone a bit crazy with the sun live in the back room, and it was incredible.
What? He had desert rats in the back room?
The guys that had been in the army, Polish army there. With him? I remember this man, Mr. Dugosz, who was completely crazy. He felt sorry for him. He used to let him live in the back room. And as kids, we would always be talking to Mr. Dugosz, who was completely mad.
So you grew up with characters.
Mad people.
That's sweet.
It's sort of sweet, yes.
My grandfather owned a hardware store. There was always people there. You know, it never just seemed to function as a place where people bought appliances. You know, they needed advice. They needed other things.
Yeah, how I remember, as a kid with my dad, yeah.
And how long was he around?
Well, he died when I was six, so... mom, I know.
It's so young.
Yeah, I was.
What happened?
He had a heart attack, heart problems. Then my mom kind of didn't speak Polish or couldn't carry on with the whole business. And so she, you know,
where was she
our
from?
Fortunes changed. She was a Londoner.
Oh.
She was a South London girl.
She no longer could be the conduit to the Polish
community.
No,
she couldn't be the conduit. No, she had never spoken the language well enough. So
our
fortunes came and went, and my mom did various things and worked in various places. And
odd jobs?
Yeah, she'd work in laboratories like that tested food and weird stuff, you know, and bring food home and
to test
we'd be eating it. She thought it was all right. One night she brought a load of this corned beef home, and me and my sister had been eating it, you know, for like 3 days. And then she went, "Oh, girls, don't eat that. It's unfit for human consumption. I've just found out." We're like, "It's a bit late now, Mum."
But she just brought it home thinking "Well, they don't need it."
Yeah, she would do things like that. She's crazy too. She's hilarious.
And is she still around?
No.
Oh.
No, I'm an orphan now.
I'm sorry. It happened late though.
Yeah, she lived a lot longer.
So when did you start like doing the show business?
I used to get on my mother's windowsill when my dad died and do the Tracy Ullman show. I used to pull the curtains across. Yeah,
the
original Tracy Ullman show. Started in my mother's bedroom,
and she was sad.
She was on the bed. She would sit on the bed, and I would just want to cheer her up, and I would impersonate people and put on a show and wear her negligees. And
how old were
I'd
you?
I'd pretend I was Edith Piaf and sing in pretend French. You know, she'd go, "Oh, isn't it amazing? She's never learned. She can speak another language." And she used to do a load of stupid things. And I used to pretend I was in a documentary, and my husband was in prison, and I had two kids, and I was being beaten up, and I used to do all dramatic stuff. And
where'd you get that information?
I don't know. Ken Loach films.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have siblings?
Yeah, my older sister Patty, who it was her show originally, so I'm a spin-off from her show. Yeah, she always says, "Listen, it was the Patty Ullman show, and I let you have a shot on the show, and then you spun off." Really?
Yeah. What for your whole life was a spin-off of your sister's show? What does she do?
Patty lives here. She's lived here for a long, long time. She's a accountant and a personal assistant. She worked in a bank and stuff. So
well, that's interesting that you started entertaining because your mom was sad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know that feeling. My dad was sort of a depressive, and you just want to try to help him out, get a little chuckle. It's very rewarding.
Yeah.
To get your parent to laugh.
Really was, yeah. And was my fun too, to put on a show.
Yeah.
Lots of kids like putting on shows, and so I did.
And you just always, the impersonations were just a natural thing? Or did you
I'd impersonate people in our village. Like there was a woman that lived opposite us called Annie Cox, and she'd lost her fiancé in the First World War. And she wore
married.
Wellington boots, rubber boots, and a woolen hat, and her nose dripped. always a little drip. And had a lot of cats, by the way, Mark. She was a cat person. With her cats. Of course, you could let them out in England. There wasn't a bloody great coyote going to eat them there.
Eagles.
No, hawks. This was Burnham in the 60s. And I would impersonate her. And of course, my family knew who she was. And it would just make them weep with laughter.
Yeah.
There were no Wellington boots.
Uh-huh.
So it was always people I knew and people I sort of were poignant to me. Like Annie Cox was sad. You know,
yeah.
She lived in a little house with no electricity and, you know, her fiancé had died, as I said, and she was just like this eternal virgin.
But you were never being mean.
No, I just loved her.
That's interesting, because I don't know if I thought about it as clearly as I did when I was watching some of your stuff again, that that there's a difference between making fun of somebody and honoring them, you know, in a way.
Yeah, I do. If I've ever gotten too mean, it's not been me and I've, you know...
Pushed back again.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not doing stand-up. I'm not... someone called me a social satirist once. That's wonderful, but I don't. I really am a character actress, you know, and I'm that can, you know, it makes people laugh. Some of the things I do, I'm not a comedian. I'm not a comic. That's not what I do.
But do you improvise within these characters?
Yeah.
Right. So I mean that, you know, you do have. You're not just an actress. You're an improvisation. You know.
Yeah.
You're
well, the first. Yeah. My big breakthrough was when I was 21, and I did a improvised play at the Royal Court in London, and it was just brilliant to be able to make up a play in a few weeks, and that's what I love doing.
Yeah? What was that about?
It was like about club acts in England. We had to, four of us were, we had to improvise over 14 weeks to just figure out, you know, club acts that were back in their digs at night talking, and it was, I know it sounds pretty dull, but it was really great. It was a big hit.
Who were the club acts?
I was like a singer. I was a born-again Christian singer called Beverly in sparkly frocks, and I used to get home and pray with everybody.
You've done a lot of Christian characters.
Have I?
Well, have you done a few? I saw one, a fairly recent one. The one with the niece, the no homo thing.
Oh, yeah. God. You know, that was like Birdie Godsend. That was a while ago. yeah. And... So anyway, it was
fanatics are fun to do impressions of.
Yeah, I just yes, they are. Yeah.
Do you sometimes like I don't envy them, but like they're the way they're so sure.
I know. I wish I was.
Yeah, right.
I know.
I mean, I guess that's the big perk of having very narrow-minded beliefs and
it's easier maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens after that, the Royal Court thing? Let's
then
go through it.
Then I got poached to do like a poached. I mean, I just got asked to do a BBC sketch show with a couple of guys. And I remember saying, oh, I don't know if I could do that. You know, women are always just the butt of sexual jokes. And I haven't got big tits and I'm not blonde. And I you know, because all there was in England at that time really was like Benny Hill. You got it, yeah. Oh, big tits. Oh, nurse. Oh, Benny's pinching her bum. Oh, mister. It was that. Monty Python, they had one girl in it, in their troupe, called Carol, somebody who always played the sexy nurse. And there were no women. It wasn't like America where you had Gilda Radner and Carol Burnett and Lucille Ball. And, you know, we were very behind.
But you had great women stage actresses,
yes,
right?
Of course. That's what I wanted to be. I mean, you know, Peggy Ashcroft and Judi Dench and Maggie Smith. They are who I aspire to be when I'm older. Oh, my goodness. They're the best. But as, you know, comedy shows, there was no sitcom, really, or a variety show with a woman
that wasn't just
heading it. No.
So you felt like hemmed in. You couldn't do anything.
No, and I thought, I don't want to be Benny Hill girl. But this show that I ended up doing after the theatre show was great. And the producer was a guy called Paul Jackson, who he'd figured out that there was a lot of young people in London at that time, like Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders.
Yeah.
And Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry and, you know, the comic strip. And he realised there was this whole wave of younger comedians and that... You know, weren't going to fit these TV formats.
What year was this?
This was like the early 80s.
Yeah. God, it lasted that
long,
huh?
He was great. And he did the young ones, you know, and he figured out, you know, that to let us
like
do what we
wave.
Could do. Yes, he was definitely new wave, Paul. And he was at the BBC, but he, you know, he just said to all the old sort of farts at the BBC, listen, we're going to try something very new.
in 1981.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, was Stuart Lee around then too?
Yeah. Stuart was,
That was his first, when he started doing before he quit and then came back.
Yeah.
He did. He like did stand up and he got sick of the audiences and then he's like, I'm done. And then he came back. He's brilliant.
And Alexi Sayle and Rick Mayall. And so, but they were very much stand up comics. I remember going to see them. I mean, I saw Dawn and Jennifer, because they were women.
They did a team thing.
Oh, they were amazing. I saw them at this club in Soho, and I just thought, oh my God, this is the future. They came on and pretended to be like American girls talking about Tam O'Shanters and stuff, and they were just so fresh and weird and wonderful. And they were women. They were really funny. So I got very excited by them. Yeah, Hugh and Stephen used to have a...
Stephen Fry?
I saw him. Yeah, they had an act together.
See, I wish I knew more about... Like, I always say this when I talk to British performers that I don't know the history of it. I didn't grow up with it, but everyone talks about, like, certainly Stephen Fry with such reverence, like, and he's a genius, and I'm sure he is, but I gotta watch that stuff. That was
their club act together, their stand-up was, I don't think there's any record of that, really. It was just maybe it is on their bit of Fry and Laurie, I'm not sure, but he was in that tradition of the real genius. And the generation before was Peter Cook.
Oh yeah, right.
Peter Cook and Dudley
Moore.
Cook was a genius. I mean, he could write. He was just in the Beyond the Fringe.
Yeah.
With Alan Bennett and Peter Cook. I mean, it was incredible.
Where does Rowan Atkinson fit into everything?
That he was like just before me, a couple of years before they did a program called Not the 9 o'clock News, and that was Rowan and Mel Smith, and it was really, really funny.
Really.
But we never had our own sort of Saturday Night Live. See, what I did when I first came to America was I didn't work straight away. James Brooks, bless him, he told me, he said, you're going to have a baby and all that, and then we'll do a show. He said, go to the Museum of Broadcasting and watch all the American stuff from the late 40s, 50s, and get a grounding.
Yeah.
And so I watched your show of shows and Imogene Coker and all those Ernie Kovacs, and I watched on all those shows that had been, formats that had come from England and vice versa. I learned so much. I used to sit there every day.
It must have blown your mind.
It was amazing. And that's when I realized how incredible the women
and James Brooks told you to do that.
He did.
But before that, you had this whole, like, you did a show with French and Saunders, right?
I did, briefly, yeah.
Was it three of you?
It was called Girls on Top, and it was with an American girl called Ruby Wax, and it was like the female Young Ones, because the Young Ones was, that Rick Mayall and Alexi said.
And how long did that last?
I just did a year, because I was having a baby, so they went on and did
married?
It a bit longer. Yeah, I was married, like, I was 20, early 20s.
How'd you meet your husband?
He was a producer on a show.
Which show?
Oh, not that one. He was, I used to see his name a lot on the credits. I think, that guy does a lot of stuff. And he, and then he saw me on television and just did that classic, I'm going to marry that girl.
Oh, really?
Which is hilarious.
What did he see you on? That would make the impression.
I don't remember?
I don't know.
He just said he was sitting in his flat. He used to live in America, though, in the 70s. He'd gone over.
The crazy 70s. He was in Hollywood in the crazy 70s. He had all the good stories.
He had all the parties with Harry Nilsson Peter Cook and Robin Williams up. He bought Spielberg's old house up on Lookout Mountain, a tiny little house.
And this before you met him?
Before he met me. Oh, he was a bugger. He was always Playboy bunny girls that crap. And he was one of those bachelors that eventually, realized it was time to settle down with a smart brunette.
Go back to England.
Yeah, and as his friend Ian Lafrenne says, you stopped him drinking, smoking, doing drugs. You basically ruined Alan's life. But he was ready to be ruined.
Yeah. But where does the big music career fit in?
Blimey. See, I've done everything, haven't I? I got to be so... This sketcher that I did that was turned out to be really good because Paul Jackson let us do modern stuff and didn't make me...
Which one?
It was
guys?
Called Three of a Kind at the BBC. With a fabulous black comedian called Lenny Henry and another guy called David Copperfield. And it kind of worked. It became the Saturday Night Show. And I was like the it girl.
It was popular?
6 months. Very popular.
What year was that? 82?
81, 82. And I remember just sitting in a hairdresser's one day getting my orange extensions put on my hair because that's where Boy George used to go. And a woman leant over and said, do you want to make a record? My husband has a record label called Stiff.
Oh, that was a big...
And she was wearing a T-shirt that said, if it ain't stiff, it ain't worth a fuck. Yeah. And I said, if I can get one of those T-shirts, I absolutely will.
And they had all the like punk rock guys.
Oh, man,
like,
it was everybody. The coolest label. Yeah, why they took great. Me on, I don't know. It was mad. I mean, it was the coolest
they were huge.
Label.
Yeah. They it had like so everybody cool. for a minute.
Oh, yeah. I had Nick Lowe and Rock yeah, Pyle doing right. my backing tracks. A Madness had written me a song. You know.
I had Nick Lowe in here.
I loved him. Great. I mean, they were the
Rock Pyle. I loved
Dave
Rock
Edmonds,
Pyle.
Yeah.
Dave Edmonds, great guitar
so,
player.
And they had Devo in America right. and Lena Lovitch and Elvis Costello and just
that was the
greatest.
Time.
It was really a cool label.
That was the time.
And I was a sort of like commercial pop wing for a second. And I had a lot of hits. And
did somebody?
I was never the real deal.
But did someone invent you? I mean, were you, who was writing the songs? What was the idea?
Kirsty McColl, the late, great Kirsty McColl, who wrote amazing songs for herself. And I just loved her. She was, and she'd written They Don't Know, a really wonderful song, and she'd released it and it had done pretty well. But I just was obsessed with doing it again. And then because I was me and I was, you know, I liked to laugh and I liked dressing up, I would just made it all kind of faux early 60s fun.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd put on beehives and purple mini skirts and do crazy videos. And I
old
think people all
songs.
Remember I had Paul McCartney in my video and because I knew him and it was cool and I got him to sit in a car with me. And so I had, you know, Kirsty was the real deal, you know, sit there with a the guitar,
yeah, yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah.
But I sort of flashed it all up a bit.
But
it worked. And
you had like
I had great fun for a couple of years doing
a couple of hit
pop
records.
Songs. I did, yeah. I had some really big hits in Europe. And then I had a big hit here with They Don't Know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's her
top
song.
Top 10 hit.
So
yeah.
She made some money.
Yeah, Chrysalis did, yeah.
Paul McCartney, how long have you been friends with him? How does that
happen?
Oh,
long time. Well, I at that time as well, I did a little part in his movie he did called Give My Regards to Broad Street.
Yeah, yeah.
Just kind of madness. And it went on for a couple of years.
He knew you from the TV show?
Yeah, and he was just... Yeah, we just got to be friendly,
with
Linda and him. Oh, it was just magic. You know, there I was. I mean, because I'd been to a Beatles concert when I was five.
Really?
And I remember my mum got tickets. And I remember sobbing and being so overwhelmed with feelings a five-year-old should never have. And if somebody had said to me then, don't worry, Tracy, you'll grow up and you'll get to meet Paul and you'll get to kiss him, actually, in a film. And I would have been like, don't be so silly. I think I'm going to explode. But
you saw them when they were wearing matching suits and everything?
Yeah, people were throwing gonks at the stage and no one could hear them. Oh, they were like stuffed toys. They were called gonks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I remember screaming and screaming.
And your mother was a fan?
Oh, well, that's why she got the bloody ticket. She loved them.
But you can remember it.
I remember that concert just being very frightened, actually.
Happening?
Yeah, I mean, it was mad. I was five. It was really frightening, Mark. I went with my boyfriend, Adam Wood. I think he was younger than me. He was like four. He wet himself. It was ridiculous. He took these two little small children.
Just
we
screaming girls.
It was horrible.
I can't imagine what... Because you really watch some of the footage of the Stones and any of those, and the Beatles, too. Like, it was just something just unleashed. Like it had never been unleashed before. Just young girls going crazy.
Going crazy. And there they are up on stage with two amps the size of a...
Four guys.
With the size of a Kellogg's cornflakes box, you know. No one can hear them. You've got distressed five-year-olds in the front row, you know.
Did you tell Paul about that you remembered that?
I told him.
Did he remember the show?
No. But I did get to meet him, and he's a lovely fella, and he's always been bumping into him all my life. And, you know, I just feel just privileged to know him, and he's lovely. And he gave Johnny, my son, a plectrum when he was like three. Johnny, a plectrum for a guitar, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Now Johnny plays guitar now.
He does?
He's just a lovely man. And I was driving up to your house today.
Yeah.
It's a nice area here, and there's those little bits that time forgot. There's still like an ad
yeah.
in a window with the Beatles in four... soda bottles.
No.
Yeah, it is. When you, I'm like, wow, it's really gone back in time, this area.
That must be at a hipster store.
It's not.
Oh,
it's
really?
No, because it's not very hipster around here, Mark.
It's gotten a little hipster.
You think?
It has.
You think?
I don't know where you came in. Did you come in a time machine? Maybe the street that you were on, is, it was from 1967. So from music, why didn't you, was there a point where you're like, I can't do this?
It was, I mean, I was just lip syncing my way around Europe. I used to sing into a hairbrush for a laugh.
Yeah.
I remember being on some dumb pop show in Holland, and they would just sort of introduce me going, hello, Tracy Ullman's here, and she's crazy. You know, that sort of, you know, when you feel just stupid, and they go, Tracy Ullman, hello. You think, oh, I just feel so stupid. I remember standing there in my purple miniskirt, and then it was live TV, and then they were doing shock tactics, and they put a live rat on my shoulder. Uh-huh. And I just thought, and I just stared this guy down. I thought, you idiot, I ain't doing this anymore.
This is it. This you is just too killed my career.
Yeah.
It's your fault. You ruined the fun for everybody.
Yeah. You twit. And,
but was your husband, he was a TV producer, so what did he think of it from the beginning? Was he like?
He's always said about me, she's a nice little learner, my Trace.
That's why he stopped partying.
Peter Cook's best friend.
Oh, really?
And they were... he made Peter Cook laugh. I mean, my husband, he was just hilarious. He's brilliant.
So you knew Peter Cook too?
A little briefly, yeah.
Because
he used to come and stay at my husband's with my husband, and they just he was really funny.
So you were really...
No, he loved what I did. He was my biggest fan.
Yeah,
and he just, you know, and because of him, I got to do a lot of shows that we, you know, produced
together.
And distributed, and he raised the money for them, so we could always, you know, I still own the catalogue now, all the shows we did together, so
we thought
we were the Desilu of London.
It sounds like you were. Kind of.
Yeah.
But did he think the music was some sort of weird kind of like, she's got to get this out of her system?
He said he liked a couple of the early ones, and then I remember I had to sing, oh, the worst thing, Mark.
Yeah.
They brought me to do the Tonight Show in L.A., and with Carson.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I remember that. Yeah. And I remember the rainbow colored curtains. And then I thought, oh, I'll do my lip syncing. I'll do my little, you know, they don't know about us. And they said, well, this is Doc Severinsen. Remember the band on the Tonight Show? And you're going to sing live.
Yeah.
And Doc's had the musicians work up a version.
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy. It was like, a scoop, do it, ba ba, ta 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 ta. So I went on with Cars. Oh my God, I thought I could just do my, you know, Kirsty McCauley version. Sure. I had to sing it like in this jazz, you know, Doc Severinsen style.
Did you pull it off?
No, it was appalling. Even my husband, who was completely tone deaf, said I sounded like a wounded horse.
Oh, no.
It was probably the most humiliating, dreadful experience of my life.
So between that and the Holland experience, it was over.
So dumb with the pop songs.
Was Johnny nice to you?
He was terrible to me. I mean, he asked me, he looked at me with his cold little, he had like blue eyes, like little bird's eggs.
Yeah.
And he just said to me, here you do a poetry show in England. Totally, something totally, totally wrong. And I went, no. And then I found that my tongue had stuck to the roof of my mouth. It was the most awful experience. I did get to go back on the show a few years later on, like, Thanksgiving night with George Burns, and Johnny, and had the most wonderful time. And, you know, that sort of vindication where I got to say to him, you are horrible to me, Johnny. You asked me if I did a poetry show, and I felt so stupid. And then we had a wonderful time. You know, so it went from being the worst thing ever to one of the nicest things ever.
Remembered?
No. Probably not.
But he took it.
And I made fun of Doc Severinsen, and I did the whole thing.
And so George Burns was 110.
He went on first, and I remember him coming to my dressing room and saying, hello. It was George, a big cigar.
Yeah.
I'm really old, so I'm not going to be on when you come on because I might die. He said something like that. And I went, oh, I would hate that for you to die beside me. George went, no, so I'll be in my little car going home. I said, don't you worry. So he did tell me he was too old and couldn't stay on for my bit.
That is classy that he knew enough to know that panel, it was, he didn't want you to feel like it was impolite.
I know.
That's
I love
sweet.
That he told me that.
Because everyone needs to sit out there together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He couldn't. I didn't blame him. He didn't know who I was.
But still very polite.
It was lovely.
So when do you start to, how does the first manifestation of the show happen?
The American shows.
Yeah.
Well, I came to America to marry my husband. We got married.
The first one was the Tracy Ullman show.
Yeah, and I met my agent out here at the time, a lady called Martha Luttrell at ICM. She did that thing where we'll start at the top.
Yeah.
You can go and see this man called Jim Brooks, and then we'll go down from there, and we'll see if he, you know.
But how? At
luckily,
that point,
he wanted to do a show with me. I just got really,
but Jim
really
Brooks,
lucky.
Like at that time, like because I've talked to him, and you know, there's several people who have had great things to say about you. One was Jim, who I had a long talk with in here, and the other one was Genji.
Oh yeah.
And Genji talked about a lot of people, but like with you, she lit up.
Oh.
Because you, I guess she was a young writer on which one? Tracy Takes On.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the first one was on Fox, so. How do you get Jim Brooks, you know, who's a sitcom guy, who was had a movie career, to do you?
I don't know. I just got lucky. He just, I
what
appealed
did he see?
To him.
What did
I don't
he
know.
See?
He just liked the thought of doing a variety show, and he had some commitments at Fox, and he just stuck with me.
Because
he's
people
kind of were
a
amazed.
Genius.
He's a genius. He's tough. He's tough. He's really, really hard to work for. I mean, he's so, you know, it's painful if you don't get it right, and you care so much about what he thinks. And he put a great team together. He put together a lady called Heidi Perlman, a great writer, and a wonderful guy called Jerry Belson, who he was just the funniest, kindest man in the world. I mean, he'd been on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and
old
he was
school
Gary
comedy
Marshall's,
writer. Yeah.
But so funny and so wicked.
Yeah.
I remember when we got our first Emmy nomination, and he was always bitching that I said he was old. He went, "It's my first nomination in color, honey." And he was just go nut. He came to LA and put an ad in the Variety that said, "Jerry Belson, funny as money, not funny, no money." You know, he was
that was his
thing, and he was wonderful to me.
And how did the show come together? What was the pitch?
It was just doing everything, just singing, dancing, me doing characters, me dressing up, me, you know.
So it had no real structure other than it's all character centric.
Yeah, it was. We love things like your show of shows. We just, you know.
And you had guys that remembered that. You had guys that like did that type of television.
Yeah, we had Mel Brooks on the lot, and he'd come in and do sketches with me, and then Steve Martin came in and did a sketch with me, and it was like, I was so shy. It was like really bizarre. You know, Steve Martin wanted to come in. I was like, he didn't talk to me all week because he's kind of an odd guy. And it was like, you know, it was like, Tracy, take him to your room and play your records. And then on the night, he was just amazing, and we did this great sketch. But it was a very, very frightening roller coaster ride of a show, and I just stuck at it and just tried everything. I had wonderful Julie Kavner.
She's great.
I adored
so
Julie. I mean, I had these, you know, Dan Castellaneta, a wonderful actor that I found in Chicago, and
they went on to, you know, to do
The Simpsons.
Yeah. And that show ran for what? How many did you do? Like 50?
We did more than that. We did like 3 seasons, I think. And it's never been repeated or shown anywhere. It's because there was so much music in it. I think the music clearances. It
gets a little expensive.
Yeah.
And that was for Fox.
That
like
was
right
for Fox.
At the beginning.
It was the first show for Fox, yeah.
Just you and Married with Children. That's all they had.
Married with Children. What did they was doing? Mr. President. Madeline Kahn was in a show, and George C. Scott was
George
in something,
C.
and Patty Duke was in something. I mean, it was.
And now it's like it became this huge thing. That was the very beginning of it.
That was the beginning.
And how did it end?
What, with me?
Yeah.
Well, it just was, we won some Emmys, and we were very, very well thought of. And then The Simpsons spun off from the show, which was, that's what people remember it for now, which was incredible.
I remember when it was on that, like, I remember that there was some sort of cultural kind of like, there's this genius lady here now.
It was sweet. Yeah, it was odd. Yeah, and I'd suddenly be on Interview Magazine,
right,
the cover.
Right.
And
every time you go look and check in with what you were doing, you're like, I don't know who she really is.
I know. And then people just thought, then there was a rumor that I was somebody from Texas, and I was just sort of impersonating.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that I was really from Texas. I don't know. But yeah, it was pretty cool. It was suddenly I was, and I got tons of offers to do things. And I thought, well, what I really can do with these characters, and I really dissolve into being other people. And that's what Jim Brooks understood. He used to sort of think I was his little Peter Sellers at one time, and that was the biggest compliment ever.
Did you love Peter Sellers?
Oh, yeah.
Like, because I imagine as somebody who grew up in Britain, that was like, he was the guy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was, you know, genius, and to be, you know.
He really was kind of like, it's hard to even explain it.
Oh, just like the early, you know, comedies of that I'm All Right, Jack. I mean, you remember from Dr. Strangelove and you know, the Pink Panther, but early English films with him, portraying people throughout the class system in England fascinated me, because that's what, you know, my whole thing about the class system.
You did a whole a series of shows about the class system.
I did a show with Michael Palin about it, and we played lots of it was great.
That's one of the benefits.
I love Palin. I just want to work more with Palin. He's a
sweetheart. Yeah.
Oh, he's adorable.
But that's one of the benefits of Britain, I guess, in a comedic way, is that you guys admit that there's a class system. In America, everybody thinks they're, you know, like, just about to be upper class.
Yeah,
or they're just poor and they're
And there is a class system here. It's more about money and stuff.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, there definitely is, but no one talks about
it. No. No.
But in England, it's sort of like, you know, the delineation.
Oh, totally. I mean, it still perpetuates, because you've got the queen at the top.
Right. Right.
And then, you got these Eton schoolboys. You know, we had Cameron and Boris Johnson and, you know, George Osborne. It was like Eton reunion in Downing Street a couple of years ago. And, you know, it's that stuff that drives me potty. And my husband was such a working class guy. It just made him nuts.
But there seems to be a maybe I'm projecting, but given the class system, that it's so entrenched and it's been going on for so long, there still is this weird acceptance of it and reverence of the queen, no matter what.
Yeah.
And you just kind of suck it up, and that's who you are until there's a Brexit vote, and then you really know what's going on.
And I've kind of got a grudging respect for her now. I mean, she's in her 90s and she's done an amazing job, but the rest of it and what it stands for, it's like we pay people millions of pounds to be better than us. You know, I just don't get it.
Line.
Yeah. And then people meet them and go, oh, they're marvellous. You go, what? Because they're up in Scotland in Range Rovers shooting things, owning all the fishing rights. What? Don't say anything nasty about her. They're marvellous. You go, why? I never got it. Yeah. I don't get it.
I guess it's, I don't know. It's historical, I guess. I mean, what else could it be?
America loves it. I mean, it's our tourists. It's wonderful. You know, people come to England and they look at the palaces and the collections and the history and the Tower of London and the beheadings and all the Henry VIII. It's fabulous. But I don't think you need people living actively in these places anymore. We'd still make just as much money showing everyone around. Like, bicycling monarchy,
Why
like
can't
the
they
Dutch,
just get
you know?
An apartment somewhere. Get the queen.
Yeah, I know.
Get the queen a nice apartment.
Fine, you know, a nice timeshare condo on Donald Trump's golf course up in Scotland, you know.
I remember I was there during right after high school, and it was Charles and Diana's wedding there, and it was crazy.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know anything about it. It just happened to be there, and I think I was in France, and the whole world was going nuts.
I know.
Did you ever meet her?
Yeah, I liked her. I felt sorry for her. I thought she was trying to, you know, do something, and she realized that you couldn't sit around and do nothing and, as I say, shoot things up in with Range Rovers in Scotland. You had to get out and meet some folk and go to hospitals and stuff. I think she earned her keep. I liked her. I thought it was a tragedy.
And they were so mad about that, in a way, weren't they?
It was odd, yeah. But it's our soap opera. It sells all the papers. People love it, really.
I think that's why they love it.
Yeah, we're never going to be a republic. You know, we did get rid of them years ago.
Yeah.
We killed Charles I, and we had Oliver Cromwell for 11 years, and it was jolly dull, evidently. He wouldn't let anybody do anything or, you know, play a lot of music. And then we got Charles II in with his long hair and his spaniels and all his mistresses, and it was fun again. You know, so we did do it once.
I guess that's what keeps the spirit up over there. It's sort of like royals have got to be crazy and fun.
And they're just more interesting and better than us. And I don't know. But
so, like, The Simpsons, like, that was just a series of interstitial stuff, bumpers?
Yeah, yes. Matt Groening came in and he'd written his Life in Hell. I remember those books.
Remember,
we used to buy those in, you know,
shops
on Melrose. Yeah. And Heidi Perlman was a big fan. And I remember him coming in and meeting him, and he's a brilliant fella. And then he created The Simpsons for the show, and seeing the first drawings of, you know,
Bart.
Marge with blue hair.
Yeah,
Julie Kavner.
Yeah.
I love impersonating her. It's so mean.
Yeah.
And they just off they went. And my goodness, it's become astonishing.
Did you get a piece of it?
I get a tiny piece of it, yes, Mark. Enough to
know,
keep me comfortable. And I know it's doing well. I was just in Italy, and you know, it's got Le Simpsons bath foam, you know, Bagno di Lavaggio in every these little shops.
Still.
And I go, Johnny, it's just paid for the holiday, kid. You know, I mean, it's just everywhere.
It's
like
crazy.
Well, it's fantastic.
Yeah. And it keeps going.
It's
so, all right. So what happens? Like, it's hard to go through your whole career, obviously.
Well, also, I won't drive everyone mad. I tried bits of everything. And then I did really classy stuff. You know, I was in a film with Meryl Streep as I was a pop star.
Yeah.
I got cast in Plenty, and that was a fabulous, you know, serious, wonderful
movie.
And
you can do it?
I can.
You can be serious.
I can be serious.
Does it bore
you? Darling,
you?
I'm a thespian. Yeah, you know, no, that was what I... And I had a wonderful time doing that.
So was there a point where you got tired of TV? And just were like, I'm gonna do
something. No, I've never been tired of TV. I like TV. It's great. That's where my strength has been. I've done a few movies. I've never had a really successful movie or... I love being a part of them, but TV's great, and it couldn't be better now.
And
you know,
you're working.
Another one the next week. It's not very good. Okay, we'll do another show next week, and it's that excitement.
The movies take for fucking ever.
And then they just sit there, and they're awful.
You never know when they're going to come out. You don't even remember what it's about by the time it comes out.
No.
So what was the HBO? How did you shift? Like,
well, I'd finished doing the Fox show, and then I had sort of great respect and interest from people and Chris Albrecht. Michael Fuchs.
Yeah, Michael Fuchs was
Karen
still there.
Strauss, yeah. And I'd done the show about class system in England with Michael Palin, and they thought that would be a good format for America. And then I took on New York, and I would take on all these different subjects, and that's how the HBO show got going.
And they were themed.
Yeah, yeah. So it gave me a central theme, and I just...
And that's where you met Genji?
That's when I met Genji. She'd been working on, I think, Friends, and she was like the kid, you know. She came in with her tight jeans, and she was always very cool, Genji. You know, she'd just been playing, you know, cards with Hispanic guys on the boardwalk in Venice. You know, she was always she had like multi-ethnic friends. You'd go, wow, Genji. And she was just... And I always felt a bit like her headmistress, though. I go, where's your script? You know, it's like, where's your homework? She'd take a bit of time turning in her homework. But when it came in, it was just fabulous.
Well, how did that work on those shows, like in general with the writers when you were doing characters? They come up, would you come up with the characters?
I pretty much come up with the characters and then...
And then they place it or...
Yeah, and then we'd find a way to apply them to that show. And I had different groups. Like I'd have Genji, my kid.
Yeah.
I had lovely girl parent who used to do the Golden Girls and had done Mary Hartman, brilliant.
Who was that? Forget her name.
Gail Parent.
Uh-huh.
And then Ian Lefrenet and Dick Clement, these English writers who they were on. I mean, I had lots of George McGrath and just this various group of people that were very diverse and eclectic, which is what I do. And some were better at writing for certain characters. And there were some characters I could just always write myself. And we would collaborate, and I'd work with different people, and it just all came together.
And would there be plenty of room for riffing, improvising?
Totally. It's like 30% to me on the day is spontaneous and happens, and yeah.
And so after all these like shows you did here, to go back to Britain, back to the BBC, must have been like going to like you were a kid again.
It was funny. I mean,
because it's like entrenched, isn't it? It's like it is what, like there's that old studio there. I did some sort of radio show there. And you feel the history if it's what I'm thinking, if it's the same building.
There's the radio studios are still there. All the TV stuff is gone now, the studios.
Oh.
But I wanted to spend more time in England after my husband died and be near my daughter, Mabel, who is just the power source and just amazing. And so, and the BBC said, would you like to come in and talk about a project? I thought, my God, I haven't been here for 30 years. And I thought I was going to go back in. It would be all the, what? You know, the old fellows with the, there was a fellow there with a bow tie, Robin Nash. And he fought in the Second World War. More jokes about traffic wardens. That's probably what? And they used to do that sort of stuff. And I thought, oh, God, if it's those guys again, I'm just sunk. And I went in, and it's now run by an incredible woman called Charlotte Moore.
Uh-huh.
And there was a young girl called My Fanwy Moore. And My Fanwy, such a Welsh name. And they just said, you know, would you like to do a show about modern day Britain? And I said, yeah, Britain's so great right now. It's a melting pot and we're all like multi-ethnic and European Union and, you know, this global hub. And you know, a year later, we vote bloody Brexit. But I did it knowing that HBO were going to take it as well, because I said, I can't just do things about England. I'm so global now.
Yeah.
And so I gave it a go again. You know, you got to crack on and do it, and found some fabulous writers, and it's been a joy.
English writers, mostly?
Yeah, but actually the guys that write on Veep,
what was it,
Armando Iannucci's crew, Kevin Cecil, Andy Riley, Georgia Pritchett, particularly. They all write on Veep, and they're, but they're English. So
that's a funny show, man.
Yeah, they're great. They're great. It's a really good team. So, and it's, you know, it's come together, and I do impersonations now, which I never really used to do, but
what are you,
I realized
about?
They,
oh, you,
would,
you did, there's a difference between characters and impersonations.
And I thought, so in a way, it's been a bit naughty because I do Judi Dench.
Oh, she, you do it great.
And Blair's a national treasure, and she's so well thought of that she can shoplift and nobody does anything about it.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, I was stealing from the legend that is Judi Dench. And
it was great. It was
Camilla,
very funny.
Parker Bowles, you know. The,
that was, that's funny too. I watched
Maggie
that.
Smith. And Angela Merkel has been a big hit for me.
Yeah.
I just sort of imagined her as somebody she probably isn't. And
right.
It's been, that's,
well, it's
been
hard
wonderful.
To, it's hard to read, huh?
I think that she thinks she's very sexy and she's a big sex bomb, sex bomb. And that Jean-Claude Juncker is always trying to, you know, to smell her sexy mask. And I imagined her as somebody that's amongst all the men, and she's wearing a beige suit and she's a very sex bomb. So that was my premise for her. That's the, been the problem. Everyone's trying
just
to hit on her.
Oh, really? So she had to shut down?
You know, with what's going on in America and her allegiance with Macron in France and Germany together, you know, they're becoming, I think, Americans are much more aware of her.
Oh, yeah.
And I just love Brigitte Macron. I want to be her. And I love the way Trump said to her, you look great.
Yeah.
You're physically in great shape. Oh, yeah. Shut up. It's so embarrassing.
And you do, oh, you do Melania too?
Oh, we did Melania like as a Westworld robot that the Russians have sent in years ago. What she was an early robot, and then now, you know, she's like mere space station. She needs to be dropped into sea, but they're trying to keep her going.
Yeah,
because they need the information. But she's really old now. She needs to be replaced. So we keep having her coming in for a retool.
That's hilarious.
Well,
and they're all available on HBO now?
Yeah. They get the, there's the first season's on, has been on HBO already, and the second season will be on after Bill Maher's show in October. So
great,
yeah, good.
And you
slot.
Got nominated for Emmy?
I did
again.
Yes,
how
nice.
How many have you won?
I've got 7.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's lovely.
It's exciting.
Yep. I know. I'm still doing it. Look, you know.
Yeah, it never gets old winning awards, does it?
No, it's lovely. It gives everyone a boost. People love it. The Emmys is like the top thing. It's lovely. You know.
Do you do a much stage work?
No, I couldn't do stand up or stuff. And I.
But what about acting on the stage?
I have done plays at times. I'm just not an 8-show-a-week person.
Yeah.
I find it hard. I don't know. You've done theatre.
A little. I do stand up. I mean, yeah. I haven't done much theater, and I just did my first couple of TV shows, and that, you know, I have a whole new, like, you know, one thing you realize as a stand up is that maybe I didn't get into this to work. Because, like, you know, I loved acting and stuff, but there is a lot of waiting involved where you're kind of like, okay, it's about to happen.
Oh,
I'm about, yeah, I'm gonna,
films are even worse.
Yeah, I know. But I love doing it. I loved, like, I did my own show for 4 seasons, and that was great, and that was very busy. But you work your ass off, and you're wearing heavy makeup.
Oh,
like, I can't. Like, I have to imagine that some of the bits that you do, you're in the chair for a day. Is it 6 hours? What?
It's just, no, there's no makeup I will do anymore that takes more than 2 hours. I mean, they have to be pre-painted and, you know, ready to go, and I get 2 guys to stick it on me in the morning, and then I... But if I'm in them for more than 14 hours, I start to go a bit nuts. It's like spelunking. It's like, you know, being buried alive. And there's nothing worse than a member of the crew walking past you and saying, are you okay in there?
Yeah.
In there. And you're covered in glitter. You're like, and you stupid sod, why did you mention that?
In there.
Are you okay in there?
No, help me.
Help me.
Give me out. Give me out.
And I'd be in a fat suit and a... You know, with a oxygen tank thing beside me to keep me cool, and the, you know, the wig, and the, and you think, oh boy, why am I? What do I do this for? And it's, but it's, I just love it.
That's,
if I try
commitment.
And look like me, what's the point? So what? You know, I'm still doing it, and I still love it. I'm doing more because of the political scene. Actually, people really want current stuff. It was no good like shooting a show and 6 months later, the piece with Angela Merkel or Theresa May or Melania Trump coming out. You know, it's got to be like Saturday Night Live a little bit.
Week.
You know, we've been writing stuff like on and shooting on a Thursday, and it goes out on the Saturday.
You have to
and
now.
You have to, because
the news cycle, so
the news cycle, and people's attention span and everything. So it's kind of exciting working that way.
But where was that piece that I saw or I watched of Theresa? I mean, it seems like you did. They're long form pieces. They're not sketch pieces. They're you give these characters time to breathe.
Yeah.
Because you sort of have to in order to give it some depth and to make it really hit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's good writing. I mean, you're not just going for some weirdo.
No, it's not
tag.
A quick, cheap impersonation of just being me. No, I really like to know what the underlying stuff is. And yeah, that was, but that, you know, we got to mention within that sketch,
The
stuff that hadn't even happened yet. So, you know, that was, that's what I like to do. Yeah,
long
exactly.
Form.
And no laugh track and stuff. And,
no, it's much better.
No.
So what, in looking back, do you know why, do you get lost in characters? You seem to like yourself. I mean, you don't seem to be uncomfortable.
I'm a really normal kind of person. I mean,
right.
I'm not like, you know, dark, depressed.
But there's no reason.
I'm supposed to be so miserable losing comedy. I mean, I've had some bleak things happen to me, but I'm a pretty sensible person.
But you're not getting lost in characters because you can't, because you can't stand.
No, I soon snap out of it.
Yeah.
Because my family be like, oh, shut up.
Enough.
Enough. Stop it.
So do you have a place here too or what?
Not anymore. I don't live in LA anymore.
So you're just running around
doing the thing? I just come back in and see my son and... because I'm in England mostly, and you know what you tend to do when you come to LA nowadays?
What?
Medical.
Oh, really?
Because over there, you know, they don't know anything about preventative medicine. You know, it's like, well, if you haven't got flames coming out the top of your head, you don't need to see me, do you? And here, you can fill like weeks with like, you know, minor medical appointments.
Oh, so
they love it here. It's such a big business here.
Well, right, but you've also got the guild coverage, I imagine. So
I
you just go down to Bob Hope Health Center. That's so funny. That's a vacation. Like, you have national health care there, which is fine, but you can really make a week of it here.
You could really make it. Two at my age, please. It's always bits to do. Maintenance, you know.
So you got all up to speed? You know what you got to
eat?
Yeah,
I sort of do that once a year. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're well. Thank you for talking.
I'm well.
Yeah.
It's nice to talk to you.
I think that was good. Do you feel good about it?
Yeah.
I was nervous about it. So I had to talk about it.
Do you not like talking to girls?
No, I like talking to girls.
Who do you like talking to?
I like talking to everybody.
Guys,
but
similar types that you
yourself. No. What happens to me is that because I put so much reliance on the conversation occurring, that I don't really do a lot of like structural questions. So like I always get nervous sort of like, what if we don't talk? What if that doesn't happen?
Some people aren't spontaneous. What if you had anyone in here that's a bit stupid and dull and doesn't talk back to you?
Well,
I mean, I know I just talk ad nauseum and probably talk a load of crap, but I always think if I spoke to someone and they just like think, they just stopped.
What used to happen, what sometimes happens is that people expect to be interviewed. So if someone comes in here and they're just sort of like, okay, then I'm like, oh no.
The publicist sitting behind them.
No, I don't let anyone in here.
I
don't let anyone in here, but sometimes it takes like 15, 20 minutes to find one thing that'll just open it up. Like something will open it up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you don't know what it's going to be. You just don't know what it's going to be. Like I've had people come in here like John C. Reilly. He literally comes in and goes, I don't like doing these. It ruins the mystique about who I am. And thank God, I used to have a clown painting in my house. And he just went off on clowns for like 20 minutes.
Right.
I'm like, thank God for clowns and that he loves clowns.
He likes clowns.
Well, it was just like
clowns.
A way to talk.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know when it's going to happen.
Yeah.
But no, I like talking to everybody. I've never had that big of a problem. I like talking to girls. It's nice to talk to women. Does it seem like I have a problem?
No, some comics are such a man's world. Many either like women or they don't like women, especially in comedy, I think. You know, there's a real boys club group.
I think that's true. I believe that's true, but I think that they've been proven wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe you need to remind them occasionally.
Well, it's a great time for girls right now. I mean, it's like, it's me going on about reminding myself about Carol Burnett, about Lily Tomlin, about Gilda Radner, about Lucille Ball, about Gracie Allen, George Burns' wife.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah.
Genius.
Amazing.
I don't think that people give Carol Burnett and those people enough credit, really. I've wanted to talk to her. I am Lily Tomlin. I've tried.
Yeah.
I've talked to Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
She's shy.
Who, Carol Burnett?
Carol, she is really. I mean, she's just a lovely, lovely actress. I mean, her, you know, she was so endearing and so loved. And so, yeah. And then so, you know, some of the sketches, they're so fabulous. She's so sad.
Yeah, I know.
And it's to
so
talk
heavy.
To her about her time on the CBS lot.
Yeah.
And how she felt like she was the goody-goody lady doing her show. And the Smothers Brothers next door were like smoking dope and saying, we're the bad boys. And you've got to talk to her about being on the lot at that time. It's fabulous.
But you do think now that the sort of boys club is diminishing a bit, don't you?
Yeah, a little bit. Because it was...
Because there's so many great shows. Like Insecure is another great show.
Oh, yeah. She's gorgeous.
Great.
Love her.
I got to talk...
And then I love Donald Glover, you know, just sort of in Atlanta. It's my new favorite one.
That's a great show.
But I love seeing ensemble shows where everyone can...
Yeah, Veep is real good at that.
Veep is great.
It's crazy. She's crazy funny.
Yeah.
They do like some...
We got to have a woman in late night now. It's a bit much. We've got Samantha Bee, and that's great, but it would be nice to see...
That's true.
Yeah,
as a host.
Know, we can't keep have the women in daytime giving away hair dryers and talking about ovarian cancer. I mean, let us do some late night shit, guys.
I think you just pitched for your late night show. Are you ready to host?
No, I couldn't do it.
No?
No, not me, but...
Well, I'm glad that your show's still on. I'm glad you're still working.
Thank you very much for talking to me. It's lovely to talk to you.
That was Tracy Almond. Almond? No. Tracy Almond. And as I said, the second season of her HBO show, Tracy Almond's Show, premieres this Friday, October 20th. Please go get the book if you haven't gotten it. Waiting for the Punch, Words to Live By from the WTF podcast by Mark Maron and Brendan McDonald. Bunch of people in there, 150, 160 bits and pieces of interviews themed beautifully, contextualized through chapters that you can all relate to. Yeah, it's a good book. You can go to get it at a bookstore. You can go to markmaronbook.com. So there's that. And I'll noodle for a second. And then I got to go. Boomer lives!